This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega. On Monday, the Biden administration announced that it had repatriated Abdul Latif Nasser out of the Guantanamo Bay detention facility and back to his home country of Morocco. Nasser was held at Guantanamo for nearly two decades. U.S. officials accused him of fighting with the Taliban against the U.S. military in Afghanistan in 2001. But Nasser was never charged with a crime, and he was approved for release from Guantanamo back in 2016. But that never happened, a sign of the deep-seated political disagreements that have hung over the detention center since it was first used to hold detainees starting in 2002.
It's important for Americans and others across the world to understand the kind of people held at Guantanamo. These aren't common criminals or bystanders accidentally swept up on the battlefield.
For many years, it's been clear that the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay does not advance our national security. It undermines it. It's counterproductive to our fight against terrorists because they use it as propaganda in their efforts to recruit.
This morning, I watched President Obama talking about Gitmo, right? Guantanamo Bay, which, by the way, we are keeping open, And we're going to load it up with some bad dudes, believe me. We're going to load it up.
Do you think that you will succeed in getting Guantanamo Bay closed?
That is my hope and expectation.
But 39 detainees still remain at the facility, only 11 of whom have actually been charged with war crimes. And according to the New York Times, U.S. taxpayers are paying $13 million per Guantanamo detainee per year. Now, we'll have more coming up on the Biden administration's approach to releasing detainees from Guantanamo. But first, we want to focus on a more personal aspect of Abdul Latif Nasser's story. In February 2020, the WNYC podcast Radiolab released a multi-part series called The Other Latif, in which the show's co-host, Latif Nasser, reported extensively on the man whose name he shares. Now that the subject of his series has been released, we want to check back in with Latif Nasser about this important update. Latif, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
So something that you sought to learn in the podcast series was how Nasser ended up imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay. What does the U.S. government say about that?
Well, that's part of the problem. As you said, like he's never been officially charged with anything. We know from leaked documents from over a decade ago, basically what they thought this guy did. You know, there's a pretty nefarious laundry list of things: being a top explosives expert for Al Qaeda, being a top military advisor to Osama bin Laden, blowing up the UNESCO World Heritage Site, the Bamiyan Buddha statues, fighting the U.S. and coalition forces at the Battle of Tora Bora. So there's a big list there that we know from these DOD documents from over a decade ago.
So he's been there. He was there for almost two decades, held at Guantanamo. What was his experience like there?
His experience was he wasn't waterboarded. He was exposed to treatment that I think many people would call torture, including sleep deprivation, prolonged solitary confinement, exposure to extreme heat or cold, loud noises, sensory overload. He has hearing, long-term hearing damage because of that. But yeah, I think that was probably more early on in his time there. But ever since then, I mean, he's just one of 40 guys out of prison.
And he was supposed to go back to Morocco now 5 years ago, right? He was approved to be sent back to Morocco back in 2016. Why did that not happen?
So he got approved unanimously by six big agencies in the United States government to leave Guantanamo in 2016. Basically, what happens is during the sort of tail end of the Obama administration, the thing that keeps him at Guantanamo is paperwork, basically. There's this bureaucratic log and diplomatic log jam. And basically, at the end, the thing he needed was a signature from the Secretary of Defense, which he just didn't get. And so he was sort of kept there by paperwork. And that made it so he couldn't get out in the Obama administration. Then the Trump administration came in. You just played the tape of what President Trump wanted to do with Guantanamo, not let people out, but load it up. He did let one guy out, but that was to a Saudi prison. So in terms of detainees, it was pretty much the same under Donald Trump. And then now, over the last 6 months, it's just been a matter of, I think, the Biden administration kind of getting together who and what they want to do with and their strategy about what they want to do about Guantanamo.
You make the point about the detainee who was released under President Trump into a Saudi prison. What is our understanding about what lies ahead for Nasser? Apparently, his lawyers say that that there's an expectation he'll be reunited with his family. But I'm wondering about the other legal battles that he will face in Morocco.
Yeah, so there's sort of pending an investigation pending on, and I got the language here, his alleged involvement in the perpetration of terror acts in Morocco. So all the former Guantanamo detainees that were released to Morocco kind of were also investigated in this way, whether it's kind of a real serious investigation that could mean that, you know, he is facing more prison time. That's a question. Or is this kind of just a perfunctory thing to say, okay, let's just, you know, review this guy? It's unclear at this point, but he is still technically under investigation in Morocco.
So I'm wondering about, he was not the only detainee cleared to leave back during the Obama administration. I'm wondering if you currently have any sense as to whether or not others who were cleared to leave under that administration will have an opportunity to be repatriated, or why it was Nasser who was the first.
Yeah, as of now, after Abdeldeep Nasser left, there are 10 more guys who are in this position where on paper, basically, they're allowed to go, but they just can't. Basically, the reason why I think Abdeldeep Nasser was the first for the Biden administration is that one of the folks I talked to who sort of put together that transfer package, he said it's not that Abdeldeep Nasser was low-hanging fruit. Abdeldeep Nasser was no-hanging fruit. He was the whole package was totally put together. It was really just that kind of final bureaucratic say-so that was preventing him from getting out. So I think that was sort of the easiest layup in terms of a transfer that they could do.
So you were just talking about someone who you spoke with as part of the series, but of course you did not get to speak with Abdul Latif Nasser himself because he was being held in Guantanamo. Does the fact that he's now in Morocco raise any possibility that you might actually have that opportunity to continue reporting by speaking directly with him?
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping. In my experience with this series, trying to interview released Guantanamo detainees, they've been the most sort of difficult sources I've had in my career as a journalist. Both getting access, getting them to agree to want to sit down for an interview, which, you know, to them feels like another interrogation, you know. And then the interviews themselves are very, very sort of delicate, given that there's so much kind of trauma in the air. So I very much would like to interview him, but I'm approaching it as carefully as I can.
As you talk about that sort of journalistic ethic about how careful you need to be and how, you know, maybe determined you need to be in finding this source and having an opportunity to speak with this source, I'm wondering about the story in general. I mean, part of the reason you made the series was because Guantanamo had largely fallen off the radar. You know, our attention was tuned towards lots of other things. But one might suggest, perhaps maybe particularly the Biden administration, that a quieter approach might be more valuable to them. So I'm in terms of actually getting these approved detainees released, I'm wondering about the balance that you see between telling the stories versus sort of holding back a bit on the stories because of the politics.
I've heard that argument before, and I think probably strategically, tactically for the administration, that sort of makes sense. I could see you making the opposite argument as well, but I do think for me and for my team, it's our job as journalists to shine a light in this, you know, on this black hole, this legal black hole. I think it's important for us to to say, even, you know, almost 20 years later, holding people for 19 years without charges, without a trial, torturing them, that is medieval. That's wrong. We have to all keep witnessing that. There are sort of political tactics, but I think that, like, for us, we're journalists. Sunlight, you know, sunlight has value.
Disinfectant.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think we all, like, this is what has gone on legally. Like, that's a pre-modern thing. That's a pre-Magna Carta thing to hold people for that long and not charge them with anything. And that's not okay.
I'm thinking also that at times journalists are taught that that the best way to report stories is with as much personal distance as possible, to be sort of the most objective. And yet the series is so rooted in your own interest here, and your own interest, not ideologically, but literally because you all share a name, and because that shared name has meaning, perhaps even for your experience in the U.S. I'm wondering if you can talk about the journalism associated with telling a story about the other Latif.
Yeah, it was a deeply personal story, way more personal than any story I've ever done. And compounding that, both the questions of religion and identity and, you know, why we believe and act the way we do. While reporting this series, I was becoming a citizen and studying for my civics exam and thinking about, you know, questions of due process and equal rights and things like that. And just seeing this man's story sort of buck all those values that this country is supposed to stand for, you know what I mean? And for me to be personally signing up for that, it felt weird.
Latif Nasser is one of the co-hosts for Radiolab and lead reporter for the Radiolab series, The Other Latif. Latif, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
With me now is someone who's reported closely on Guantanamo from the base itself for years. Carol Rosenberg is the Guantanamo reporter for the New York Times. Carol, thanks for coming back on The Takeaway.
Thank you for including me.
Can you talk a little bit about the status of other detainees who have been cleared for release under the Obama administration?
There are four other men at Guantanamo among the 39 detainees who were in a similar situation to Abdellatif Nasser. One, Soufiane Barhoumi of Algeria, had been in an absolute similar situation, meaning diplomats had arranged for his repatriation and he should have been going home in the very tail end of the Obama administration. But something went wrong. Just like Abdellatif, the arrangements came in too late, and he has sat there throughout the entire Trump administration because during Trump, they've just basically ended all transfers but one. During the Trump administration, they sent one man, a convicted terrorist, to Saudi Arabia, to prison. So there were four others like Abdellatif, but three of them really never had arrangements to go anywhere. The situation as of today is there are 10 men among the 39 for whom the Biden administration needs to find countries to take them in, either in some instance repatriate them, or in other instances find rehabilitation programs to absorb them.
So you reported earlier this month that officials in the Biden administration are divided on whether the Justice Department should take the position that Guantanamo detainees actually have due process rights. What is the nature of this disagreement?
Well, at the end of the day, they took no position. They decided to, I guess that's a measure of just how divided they were. The ability of the U.S. government to hold someone as a law of war detainee at Guantanamo in what is coming up on year 20 of this war with Afghanistan relies to a certain degree on legal definitions. They are held as war prisoners. With one exception down there, nobody is convicted of a crime, but 10 or 11 are awaiting trial. So the question of whether someone is entitled to due process would be significant for the men who are held as war prisoners, no charges, no release. The position, as a matter of law, the Biden administration has adopted the same legal positions as all of its predecessors, that this war on terror, this war that exists with Al-Qaeda, is bigger than the battlefield. When we leave, when the last troop leaves Afghanistan, they say the authority to detain someone as a prisoner on this war on terror continues. The pendulum of whether due process rights applies could help those men who are sort of like POWs in this war in the federal courts as they seek release. We had been watching, we had expected some sort of perhaps more liberal interpretation of what rights a detainee could use in order to get out of Guantanamo, and some sort of clarification in the death trials down there, the capital trials down there, on absolutely what evidence could apply. It didn't happen in this question over at the appeals court on the, in the due process challenge. And so they took no position, which was a surprise, but in a way a little bit different than the previous position that they had no due process rights.
Right. So there wasn't an affirmative statement of the rights, but there also wasn't a clear sort of discourse that those rights don't exist. I'm wondering about that kind of non-position, because you've reported that the Biden administration is trying to be a bit more quiet in its transfer of detainees out of Guantanamo, in part having learned from the backlash that the Obama administration experienced. And yet, here you and I are talking about it on the radio, in part because you wrote about it in the New York Times. So is it really quiet?
The due process clause question really is about this administration retaining the prerogative to hold people as a matter of law. But as a matter of policy behind the scenes, quietly, I guess you could say, there's a ton of brainstorming going on. How to get people out, where to send them, who to put on trial. They haven't backed away from any of the trials, but there's three men who have yet to be arraigned down there. So there's different pockets of government deciding how to achieve, if at all possible, President Biden's aspiration to close Guantanamo. Closing Guantanamo means not leaving the base, but stopping the prison, picking up and moving those detainees elsewhere. In some instances, sending them to other countries. In other instances, they would need to bring them to the United States.
So as part of this sort of delay, obviously there was the Obama administration's attempt, and then, you know, we had a Trump administration in between, but there was also, and there is continuing, a global pandemic. I know you were away for about 500 days and then returned last week to report from the base. Can you talk about what Guantanamo has been like during the pandemic?
Sure. It was like locked in time. The guards came and went. You know, there's over 1,000 Army National Reserve troops down there working at this prison, which now has 39 detainees. They would continue their 9-month rotations, but the court was closed. The legal the legal proceedings came to a full stop. The media was not allowed, as you said, for 500 days. I left in February 2020 and was just allowed to return for the first media visit at last week. They managed to get the construction going. So the place is one big construction zone. There's a $125 million barracks for 850 of those prison guards to live in during their stays going up. That's a Trump administration program. So in a sense, for the period of the pandemic, let's say Guantanamo was status quo. Nothing changed for the detainees. Nothing changed in terms of, let's say, the guard program. They did have quarantines as people came in, but all the personalities changed. There's a new commander down there. There's new guards down there. There's new captain of the base. And so as a result, when Guantanamo reopens itself to the world and we go back down for hearings, the only people who've seen a hearing the last time it occurred are the prisoners, the press, and the lawyers. Even the judges are new coming in to hear these cases.
You have been reporting from Guantanamo for a very long time, even before the first detainees were sent there. Just sort of from how you're feeling, you know, being, again, having gone back after 500 days, do you think that the closure of the prison complex there can actually happen relatively soon?
It certainly cannot happen relatively soon. It cannot. The release of Abdellatif Nasser was one of the easiest transfers available to this administration. It had been done by diplomats of the Obama years. This administration was candid in which they said they used the same arrangements that had been made during the Obama years, and it took them for some reason 7 months, or in the intervening 7 months when the president took over, to get the Moroccan government to affirm it. There is tremendous amount of hard work to come, and a tremendous amount of politics to make some hard decisions about what to do in individual cases, and what to do with individual prisoners. For this detention center to close, there would have to be thousands upon hours of diplomacy, some willingness of Congress to let the Defense Department, the administration, move some of these detainees to a U.S. soil setting. As quietly as they are making arrangements for things, there can be change, there can be releases, but there is a very high hurdle to the notion that they can get the last detainee out of Guantanamo and send him somewhere else.
Carol Rosenberg is the Guantanamo reporter for the New York Times. Carol, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.